The Top 100 Clubhouse podcast is brought to you by Eden Mill, bringing the tradition of distilling whiskey and gin back to St Andrews, the home of golf. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Top 100 Clubhouse, the ultimate podcast for golf course enthusiasts worldwide. I'm your host, James Henderson, and we're about to embark on a journey through lush fairways and breathtaking landscapes, as well as delving deep into the minds of fascinating individuals from every corner of the golfing universe. Get ready to explore the world's top golf courses through the eyes of those who know them best. This week in the pod, I sat down with Cal Cruikshank. Cal's a fascinating individual who's worked all over the world, from Royal Melbourne to Muirfield, and is now the course manager at the fantastic North Berwick West Links. I wax lyrically about it, and I'm fortunate to be a member myself. And what he's doing has got everyone excited. Changes that are sympathetic renovations of a golf course that is close to my heart. So I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Top 100 Clubhouse.
Right.
It's great to have you on. Obviously, I'm a member here, so I'm very excited by what you're going through right now. Can you give us a wee bit of your background? How did you fall in love with golf?
Yeah, so I was born and brought up in Aberdeenshire, a small village just outside of Boyne. And my mum was the big golfer in the family. She kind of often played golf at Ballaturn, Balmoral. Every week. She's club champion at Balmoral for about 30 odd years. She was a club champion at Ballater twice, and I think she's also a club champion at Braemar once upon a time.
Some fun little courses there.
Yeah.
Really, yeah. Worth a wee trip.
Yeah, so I'm from a place called Lumphanan, and the nine-hole course there is on the side of a hill, and it's quite famous for any pennant matches or local matches. Lumphanan always wins because they know their way around, so it's quite an interesting little track. But I'm a member at Balmoral, which is a nine hole just beside the castle. So I pretty much spent my childhood up there playing golf when I was going to visit my granny and granda. Very lucky that they're still alive and still on the estate up there. So
I was about to say, your granny and granddad isn't the Queen. And
No. My granny was a housemaid for the Queen, and my granddad was a farmer.
Seriously?
Yeah, on the estate. So mum was kind of born and brought up on the estate, and, you know, maybe didn't get to know the royal family, but knew a lot of people around them. And a lot of the personal protection officers used to stay at my granny's house when the king and queen, queen was up at the time, now the king. So yeah, it was quite an interesting background. But I think when you're from a place like that, you just get used to it. It doesn't really feel different. And then you see, you know, the king might be up there on his holidays or whatever, and you see it and you're like, oh God, that is... It is a little bit strange. It's not normal to have someone like that in your back garden. But so yeah, I played golf at Balmoral. And pretty much any time I was at my granny and granddad's, just went out and played.
What's the course there like?
Yeah, so it's a nine-hole course, but it's got 18 tees. And it's not long by any stretch, but it's quite fun, quite challenging. A few holes that go up a hill, a few holes that come down. And it's really
there,
good fun.
Around there, there's a lot of hills.
Yeah. But no, it's good fun. And pretty much just from there, developed a love of golf. Never took it seriously enough to think I could ever be a player. It was more just for the fun of it. And I was sitting in academy one day, and there was just this poster on the wall that said, "Enjoy golf. How about becoming a greenkeeper?" And pretty much from that moment on, that was me sold. You know, I couldn't really think of a better job for someone that liked golf, liked being outdoors, was quite, you know, sporty when I was younger. I just thought, yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. So helped out for a week or two at Balmoral, helping the greenkeeper there. My mum at the time was actually assistant secretary at Ballater, so she sorted me out with a school holiday job at Ballater Golf Club. And pretty much from there, just left school at 16, got an apprenticeship at Inchmarlow Golf Club, which is just outside Bankry. Got my qualifications, went off to Ireland for 6 months to work in a golf construction site, but it was right at the end of the Celtic Tiger, so
it kind of
fell into liquidation. And
so it was never finished?
No. The
what was the story? Was it a big project?
It was Retief Goosen designed course.
Oh, right. Okay.
hotel. It was an old manor house that was going to be redeveloped and turned into a hotel. And it was Sol Golf that were constructing it. And pretty much there's, I think, 20 million euro put into the ground and nothing ever came of it. Yeah. So there's drainage, irrigation, you know, half a hotel was built, renovation started on the big house, and then they ran out of money. So everything had to stop. So unfortunately for me, that was my kind of time in Ireland finished quite abruptly. But from there, I went to Elmwood College to do my HNC full time.
Yeah.
So I came out of it not too bad.
Did you ever want to go into that side of the golf game, the more construction side?
It was quite weird being there, because when you worked in a golf course for a couple of years, you're kind of used to having grass there and, you know, maintaining the golf course for players. When you're on a construction site, at the time, it probably moved very slowly. Not too much was happening there, in the sense of, you know, one day you're laying drainage and the next day you're still laying that same bit of drainage. It was quite a tedious process. Probably the older I've got, the more I've enjoyed it. But at the time, I just remember thinking, I just want this to be a golf course, and I just want this to be finished. But unfortunately, we just never got there.
Yeah, no, it must be quite frustrating seeing all that work then just disappear.
Yeah.
It's probably built into houses now, isn't it?
I think even there was a housing development as well, and I think it's just known as a ghost town.
Oh, is it just completely empty?
Yeah.
Wow. That's such a shame. So then you went on to do your, was it HNC?
HNC, Elmwood, yeah. So I did that for 6 months.
Where are you based?
In Cooper, Elmwood College. So that was great. You know, Elmwood's, I did my apprenticeship there, and I've done my HND there down the line as well. And
is that the main place in Scotland for that kind of stuff?
Yeah, pretty, I go as far as say probably main place in Europe for greenkeepers to go to. Certainly a lot of international students go there to learn as well. And, you know, it's a place that I try and, you know, I thank them for what they've done for me. So I'm trying to push a lot back onto them as well. So we've got three of our guys currently doing their qualification through Elmwood as well, which is great.
And do they work closely with St Andrews then, or is it?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of a tie-in with St Andrews. And, you know, we used to take field trips to St Andrews and go and look around the sheds there, or go up to the Dukes and have a look at the course up there. So there was quite a good tie-in with St Andrews and the Lynx.
Yeah, because Cooper's so close, it's not far at all. Did you ever think St Andrews might be the stop you want to be at?
Funnily enough, I was never at that moment in time, because I'd never really been exposed to Lynx golf. I've always been kind of parkland inland courses. I never really thought it was for me. But once I finished my qualification, there was an advert going out for greenkeepers at Glen Eagles, which I thought was kind of more up my street. So I got a job there after college, and I was put straight onto the PGA Centenary course, and it was kind of doing the build up for the 2014 Ryder Cup. So it was a great time to be there. Pretty much went in with not a lot of experience and came out with experience of doing a lot of things, you know, using diggers, drainage, irrigation, obviously, you know, day-to-day work out in the course. But it was just great to be able to be a part of quite a big project going into quite a big event.
Also at a very high level.
Yeah.
Yes, they were expecting so much at that.
Yeah. I mean, we had the Johnny Walkers every year, and I think every year there was a, you know, interest into how the course was playing and how it was going to look going into 2014. And I think it was 2011, we underwent a big kind of reconstruction job and rebuilt half the 18th to what it is now, which was quite a, you know, big project. I can't remember exactly how many kind of tonnage of material came out of that 18th hole, but it dropped quite considerably the height of it and became this amphitheatre.
Was that the whole intention, to build an amphitheatre?
Yeah, just in case, you know, the final game got there, which it obviously never did, but it was built with that kind of purpose in mind, I think. And I think the 18th before was this long uphill par five, and I think it was the last Johnny Walker that was held there. There was a five-man playoff, and it lasted five holes, and it was just pretty much the same hole every time. It was quite tedious and boring, whereas, you know, once the new 18th came in, there was a bit of jeopardy there. You know, it was quite a narrow long green, which massive swales either side, so if you didn't quite hit the right shot, you're going to be penalized, as opposed to, you know, hitting an uphill shot into, you know, an uphill green, pretty much.
The one thing I want to, as a greenkeeper who's worked at Gleneagles, one thing I've not asked someone is, I hear a lot about the quality of the soil that's at Gleneagles. Seems to be a bit different to everywhere else in the inland courses around there. Is that true? Is there's kind of a...
Yeah, there's, I mean, certainly in the PGA, there was a lot of issues with drainage there.
It's a bit, quite a bit wetter than the other
two,
isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, central Scotland, you're pretty much getting rain nine times out of ten. And it's, you know, funnily enough...
Pretty hard to work in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so used to wearing waterproofs every day at work just from working at Gleneagles. But yeah, I mean, certainly there's areas in the PGA that were, you know, really heavy soil and there was a lot of drainage put in. And I think what didn't help was the fact that a lot of the drainage that was put in initially was storm drainage. So it was built for that once in a 20-year storm and it would move water really well. But day-to-day rain, where it just kind of rained constantly, it couldn't really soak up the same way. So a lot of secondary drainage was installed trying to combat that. The sub-air systems were installed in the greens just in case we had a repeat of Celtic Manor. Their Ryder Cup, at least we could move water quite quickly off the greens if needs be, and better billy bunker put into the bunkers so that we could, you know, they wouldn't have the same washouts and things like that. So it was, everything was kind of geared up to try and make it as dry as possible.
So what came after Gleneagles? What was your next?
So pretty much the week after the Ryder Cup, I was on a jet to Melbourne. And I went to work at Royal Melbourne for 6 months. So
not bad.
No, it was pretty good. I'd been at Gleneagles for 6.5 years. And by the time the Ryder Cup came, it was pretty much the good opportunity to leave. I was 26, I think, at the time. So I needed to kind of spread my wings and go and see something a little bit different. And yeah, I went to Melbourne for 6 months to work at Royal Melbourne, which was just incredible. Very different from Gleneagles. It took me quite a bit of time to adjust, but it certainly... you know, formed quite a impression on me and, you know, how I think about greenkeeping and golf.
What was the differences? Why was it so different?
I mean, climate obviously helps, you know, in Melbourne, in the Sandbelt, it's a, you know, a free draining soil, a really warm climate. I know the kind of joke that Melbourne gets four seasons in a day, similar to Scotland, but at least you get the warm weather.
It's about 10 degrees hotter.
Yeah. And that was, you know, the best bit about it was just going to work in your shorts and t-shirts and not have to worry about the waterproofs. But just the fact it was, everything was firm and fast. You know, Richard Forsyth, the kind of course super over there, he really prides himself on his greens and how hard they are and how fast they played. And it was just a real eye-opener to see really pure bent greens being grown in a warmer environment. And just the kind of the way that he thought about golf. We held the Asian Pacific Amateur Championship in my first or second week when I was there, which was a great event. But the brief that came from Richard was, we want the smartest player to win, not necessarily the best player. We want someone who will go around Royal Melbourne thinking their way around and plotting their way around, as opposed to someone that just stands on the tee and obliterates the ball. So I think that kind of philosophy sticks with me, and I think certainly now working on a links course like North Berwick, you're more conscious of that.
Well, you can't lengthen here.
Yeah,
there's no room for an extra tee, you know.
No. And it, you know, Royal Melbourne's the same. I mean, yeah. The interesting thing there was that the course was the defense, you know, they had re-turfed all the kind of the fairways with this type of grass called Legends Couch.
Okay.
Or Bermuda grass, which is really thick. And the idea was, instead of, you know, on a links course here where the ball hits the ground and runs for, you know, 50 odd yards, pretty much all the energy is just zapped out of the ball and it just stops. So you're not getting the same distance off the tee. Everything's a bit, you know, longer.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
And then with the, you know, the firm greens and the firm approaches, you're laying up quite short to let the ball run out and go into the green.
Well, it's got such a great rep around the world for both the golf courses. It's really the leading golf course in that area.
Yeah.
And what else did you learn while you were there? Did you learn any techniques that you hadn't experienced when you were over here?
Yeah, I think like the way Richard manages the course, hand watering was a big part of day-to-day activities. So, you know, it might be going out in the morning cutting greens, but then straight after that, you've got a hose and you're just going round hitting the greens. You know, water management's something I'm quite interested in. You know, we've got quite a, you know, an important public commodity in Scotland with our water, and it's something we need to, you know, manage sensibly. We don't want to lose that. So certainly using water efficiently and well was something that kind of opened up my eyes. You know, being at Glen Eagles, like I said, where it was wet 9 times out of 10,
you didn't worry,
didn't have to worry about
the opposite. Yeah. You're trying to get rid of it.
Yeah. But then, you know, coming onto a Lynx course, you know, it's maybe not the same climate, but it's the same type of environment where you're trying to.
Well, you're very dry here.
Yeah.
I don't know what your rainfall is, about 600-700 mil a year. Or,
oh, not even that.
Not even that.
No.
So for the Americans, that's about, what, 18, 17 inches or yeah. something? Which is absolutely crazy.
Yeah, and you know, I think Glen Eagles were measuring it in meters rather than you know, centimeters, which we measure it in.
Yeah, absolutely amazing, quite incredible. But you're right next to the sea.
Yeah.
So you had a storm the other day here, right? And
yeah.
What happened?
Storm Babette came, and you know we were working at the time, and we knew it was quite wild. And we were watching the waves out in the sea, and it was, you know, the Lamb, which is one of the islands just off the coast here, was just about getting engulfed by waves. But we didn't quite realize the damage it was doing along the coastline. So our third tee, we lost probably about a meter or two of coastline there, so much so that we've got the irrigation lines been exposed along the coastline. The back of the 14th green, Perfection, there's probably been a couple of meters kind of washed away there as well. And we've got a few areas of coastal erosion on the course that, you know, have held up really well to the storms, but unfortunately it's just everything further up the coastline that's been damaged most.
Sorry, before we move back on to other things, the coastal erosion stuff here is a major issue at North Berwick, and I don't think people really appreciate how much work is put into managing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a problem that affects us. It affects, you know, I think most of the east coast of Scotland was kind of affected in the last storms. Certainly Royal Aberdeen and Montrose are the two that kind of come to mind. So we before my time here, there was a coastal erosion installed at the second hole, which is Rock Armoury, and also at the back of the 11th green. There was geotextile sandbags installed in there to kind of help stabilise the dune.
Can you explain what that is so people cannot?
Yeah, so pretty much they're about ton sized bags of sand that have been filled up, and they're pretty much laid in a brickwork formation underneath the dune. And then all the sand was kind of put back on top of them, and the dune was reformed on top of them just to try and hold the dune in place. And like I say, the Storm Babette didn't really do too much damage to these areas, which was great because, you know, they're obviously areas that we're concerned about. It was more areas up coastline from them. Certainly the big dune that we've got that runs from the 10th tees all the way down to the 11th. A lot of the build-up of sand at the bottom there had kind of maybe 5-10 years worth of build-up had been taken in one fell swoop. So it kind of shows you that, you know, the sea is a cruel mistress and it can take almost as quickly as it can give it to you.
Do you have, this is a really rogue question, but I know the rise of sea level chat. Do you have any concerns about what's going to happen to North Berwick through that? Is that in discussion around the Greenkeeping?
Yeah, to be brutally honest, I was probably a bit naive about coastal erosion, obviously not being here when the coastal erosion was put in place. And maybe just thinking, oh, you know, we're protected, or our most vulnerable areas are protected. And that storm just proved that, you know, this is a front and center issue for the club, if not, you know, not just our club, it's, you know, courses up and down the east coast of Scotland, even the west coast of Scotland as well. You know, we're hopefully going to be getting a survey done to show what that 1 in 100 year storm might do. And, you know, it could be quite cataclysmic for the course, but, you know, we just need to protect ourselves as best as we can and make sure that our areas of interest, like the back of the 14th, green, or, you know, the back of the 11th green, are protected as best as we can.
It's scary stuff because obviously a lot of people are in love with this place, and to know that one day just you could lose a whole hole, it's...
Yeah. I think when you see the reports that come out and they say, you know, St Andrews could be underwater by, you know, 2050 or whatever it is, I think you always take them with a large pinch of salt. But I think after seeing that type of damage, it probably hits home a lot harder.
Yeah. So we'll just go back to, so Royal Melbourne, which you definitely don't have that problem. Where did you go after Royal Melbourne?
Yeah, so after Royal Melbourne, I was at Le Golf National in Paris for six months. Yeah. So again, just doing a bit of construction work in the lead to the 2018 Ryder Cup. And yeah, really enjoyed my time in France as well. It was a very different culture, and never drank coffee until I went to France. So that's my thing I took home. But I was there for 6 months, did a bit of the construction work on some of the improvements for the 2018 Ryder Cup. But I saw a job advert back home for a deputy course manager at the Roxburgh. Down the Scottish borders.
Another wet area of Scotland.
Yeah. So it was, you know, very fortunate to get that job as well, where I was down there for 4.5 years, learning under Ross Ovens. Another great experience in management and how to, you know, deal with a different side of the job as opposed to, you know, the nitty gritty of greenkeeping. You're maybe a bit more focused on man management or a bit more admin, which was what I wanted to get out of that. And then from there, my wife, we were living in Gala Shields at the time, and she was getting, you know, on the train for an hour to work every day and an hour back, and it was getting a bit hard on her. So I kind of promised her that if a job ever came up in Edinburgh or East Lothian, I would go for it. And luckily a job came up at Muirfield. So I took that and was up there for just under 10 months, I think.
As an experience at Muirfield, that must have been quite an interesting eye-opening experience, because it's got the similar level status as Royal Melbourne. Or
yeah, I mean, certainly going through the gates, anyone that's ever been to Muirfield, going through those gates every morning was just a real joy. And then kind of just seeing this golf course open up in front of you, it was quite a great feeling going into work every morning. And I mean, I've never known a golf course that just is literally getting spit polished every day. Just such good condition all the time. My first kind of experience of links courses, and you know, again, you're kind
not
of
a bad
thinking,
one to start on.
No, not a bad one. Again, you're kind of coming maybe from that Glen Eagles mindset where you're thinking, oh, we've got to do this, got to do that, and there just isn't the same concern up there. It's just, you know, everything's just pretty much spot on all the time.
Out of interest, you've obviously worked your whole career in a different style of golf course. You then arrive at Lynx. What are the differences between managing the two styles of golf course?
Yeah, I think, you know, being inland, I mean, certainly Glen Eagles, it was that wet climate, and pretty much your winters are spent laying drainage and doing kind of jobs like that, or a lot of turfing work from maybe areas that you have drained or tried to drain that have been wet and needed to be, you know, sorted out. Going onto a links or, you know, sandbelt where it's dry, you're working in a very, very different environment. Certainly through the summer where it is drier, you're maybe putting that little bit more irrigation out. You're trying to promote those finer grasses that can thrive on a links course. So you're conscious about your nutrient inputs. Whereas, you know, Glen Eagles was geared up for European Tour events, Ryder Cup. It maybe had to have a certain aesthetic, whereas, you know, a links course, if things kind of burn off a little bit, it's not the end of the world. And it's something that I think a lot of our members like to see on the course as well.
Yeah, very much so. Firm and fast is the classic phrase. And it's firm and fast has been dominating rankings, you know?
Yeah.
You see what's happened to North Berwick over the last, it's crazy how popular it's become.
Yeah. And it's great to see, you know, not just from our standpoint of setting the course up every day for, you know, members and visitors, but it's great that something that maybe 30 years ago was relatively unheard of or was a bit of a hidden gem is now being fully realized that is a great.
I think we've got it at 30th in the world or something. Yeah. And that brings me to the point of you becoming course manager here. You must have been quite excited.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. It's, yeah, it was quite incredible to be able to get this opportunity. I mean, it was all, when I was up at Muirfield, I just started doing my degree in sports turf science. And like I said before, I was really happy there, wasn't really looking to move. But my predecessor, Darren, when he started here, there was a job advert went out for a senior greenkeeper initially. So, you know, I just emailed him off the off chance to say, you know, what's going on at North Berwick, what's your plans? I wonder if you might be able to entice me away from your field. And, you know, he said, if you're looking for an easy job, don't come to North Berwick, because we've got, you know, quite a project on our hands and we've got a lot of things that we want to try and improve. And just speaking to him that day, I kind of got my juices going a little bit, and I thought, yeah, actually, as much as I love Muirfield and, you know, what it is, I think the excitement of what Darren was proposing was probably too good to turn down.
But it seems like that's been something that's run throughout your whole career. You've always been a project that's kind of had a culmination somewhere, you know. It's would you get bored at a place where you kind of sit
not
still?
Necessarily. I think it's more looking for that progression in your career. You know, getting to, when I was deputy course manager down at the Roxburgh, I think obviously the next progression would have been to be a head man or a course manager somewhere. And I applied for lots of jobs, but there was the opportunity just was never there. So taking the step back and going to a Lynx course and experiencing something different as a greenkeeper and not in a management role was probably the best thing I did, and further my experience and my knowledge of, you know, how to manage a site. And then again, coming in with Darren, it was that excitement of what, you know, North Berwick, a lot of people were talking about the course and how much everyone loved it. And it was an exciting time to be a part of something that we were going to be improving. So it was a bit of a no-brainer, really. I was really fortunate that within 6 months I was promoted to deputy. And then probably about a year later, an opportunity came up for Darren, closer to home for him in the West Coast. And it was just good timing on my part that I was here, and, you know, he'd got me almost ready for the job. So, you know, I'm forever grateful for him for his help in getting me here. But it was a
quite amazing double promotion in whatever, 2.5 years.
Yeah. I mean, and this is my first course manager's job. It's not like I've got that experience. So it's,
which would be rare for a top 100 golf course to, which shows you the trust the board have with you. It's quite amazing.
And it's a huge honor, really, you know, to be able to have this as your first job and have people put their trust and belief in you to, you know, obviously produce some things. It's a huge honor. It's a huge privilege. And, you know, I've always said I'm just the latest custodian of this Lynx course, and I just need to try and leave it in a better condition than, you know, for the next person. And, you know, a lot of the projects, which I'm sure we'll come on to, that we've done, that's all aimed at that. It's all about improving the kind of the experience that people have here, not just for the golfer, but our employees as well. We've done a lot of work behind the scenes for our greenkeepers to give them a better environment to work in.
So let's do that. Let's move on to what you've got planned and what you're doing currently. I know you've rebuilt one big bunker on 17 already.
Yeah. So pretty much the brief for 17 was last year, the club or the committee decided that they didn't want anything done to that until a course manager was in place. So shortly after my appointment, you know, we sat down and just decided that we were going to rebuild this bunker, which, you know, is quite an iconic part of North Berwick. So we had Chris Haspel, who was the kind of course manager at Castle Stewart. He consults with us. So he came down for a visit, and, you know, we kind of walked around the entire site and we looked at a few different ideas and projects that we thought in the future, but 17 was definitely the one that was most pressing. And from there, you know, Clyde Johnson came down for a look about, and we kind of decided that it was too big a job for us to do in-house, and it needed someone that had a bit more skill set, better expertise than us to be able to achieve what we were looking for.
To put into context, these guys are actual course builders. You know, they build golf courses for Tom Doak and for the likes of Gil Hance, for everyone. They're quite famous in their field.
Yeah, so I mean, Clyde had he's pretty much worked all over the world helping build courses for Tom Doak. And
he was at Tariti, wasn't he?
So it was important that we got people like Chris and Clyde on board to help us with a project like this. And certainly within my first few months of being here, it was a big project to take on. So we kind of, beginning of January, Chris and Clyde came on board. We got the big 8-ton excavator in the bunker and just got to work. And I think initially from what they started digging out, there was maybe a bit of an eye opener for a lot of the members and the visitors to see, you know, this is actually quite a big project and quite a big rebuild. But the idea was to make it, you know,
we found old sleepers.
Yeah, and we found old sleepers in the face from where, you know, maybe it was the old bridle path that was there years ago. But it was to bring back what it kind of used to be like. It probably lost its shape over the years. It lost its revetted wall, which is a feature that looked really good a few years ago. So we wanted to bring all that back. And looking at old photos, we kind of just took it from there.
Because it's not just that bunker. You've been planning a few other things. What are the other things you've been...
Yeah, so, I mean, 17 was obviously the starting point for that. And then there's been a few projects that we've kind of had our eye on for a few years. So 10th Tees was one that we wanted to make it try and fit its surrounding a little bit better. So before, it had a bit of a sheer face, and it's set in the dune, but it didn't really look like it should have been there. So the idea was to kind of dig down, take out some of the poorer root zone and soil that was in there, build it up with a better root zone, but also do a lot of landscaping around the sides. And there was a rubber crumb path that used to run from the bottom of the hill or the bottom of the bank to the top and then right through the middle of the tee, which always looked a bit unsightly. So that was one of the first things to go. We now have a full grass tee and a grass path going up from the bottom of the bank up to the tee and then coming back down again as well.
It's looking good.
Yeah, so it's a big change on what was there before, but it's definitely a massive improvement.
Opens up the views as well.
Yeah.
Big time. You've got a much nicer view across this across to Fife and down the coasts.
Yeah, certainly of, you know, the kind of four islands that are just off the coast of, you know, Fidra, Lamb, Craigleith and Bass Rock. You can open that up a lot better to have a better view of that. So from there, we moved down to the 6T. And the 6T maybe wasn't one that was most pressing to rebuild. It was more from a maintenance point of view, with World Handicap System changing and a lot more people playing off the white tee. Our first big competition of the year, the Burn Shield, pretty much an all-club event. First time that they're playing off turf after using mats through the winter. So, you know, they go back onto the white tee and within a week, it's pretty much unplayable because it's just absolutely full of divots. So my objective to Clyde was give me a tee that, you know, we can use for a lot longer and utilize a lot better. So pretty much the white tee now is probably double the size, double the width, three times the length. So now we can give, you know, players a lot better, you know, ground to play off.
I noticed you got rid of something at the back of five as well.
Yeah.
What was the intention of that?
So I'd always felt that the quarry hole, which is the six here, par three hole that kind of goes over a big dip onto the green, it was probably a great feature, but was very underappreciated. So part of, again, the objective for the 60s was to try and, you know, accentuate it a bit more and make it a bit more of a feature. And there was this mound at the back of the fifth green. So we've taken that out and now you've kind of got the feeling of an infinity green going down into the sixth hole. So it opens up a lot better. We're kind of hoping now that, you know, people get onto the fifth green and you see the next hole straight away and think, wow, that's quite a feature already. But from there as well, the green's kind of been moved out by a couple of yards. There'll be a bit of a runoff off the back of the green as well. And then next year, as part of our, you know, works as well, we'll rebuild the bunker on the right side of the green and then just soften the bank there a little bit so we can cut it all as fairway height and it'll be a bit of a bigger complex to play out of.
That'll be fun.
Yeah.
It's the one thing I did notice is the view when you're walking up is much more prevalent. You can see the whole course and it really opens the place up.
Yeah.
Where else have you been attacking the...
Yeah, so the big project, probably the one that gave me the most fear, was we started on the bunker left of the 15th green, and the 15th green here is the most copied hole in the world, which is the Redan hole.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you take lightly of making any changes to. But, you know, I've got a picture in my office of that hole from a drone, and you look at the bunker on the left, it just never really looked like it should be there. It just didn't look natural. So again, kind of said to Chris and Clyde, you know, let's try and do something with this and make it fit a lot better. So they went away and did their homework and came out with a lot of great photos of how that bunker used to be. And, you know, it's grown quite a bit in size, but it certainly is more in line with what used to be there. And I think, again, it might be a bit of a shock to a lot of members and visitors that come here to see what was there before to what's there now. But I think it suits the whole a lot better. And it was a type of, like we said, sensitive restoration where we weren't doing something for the sake of doing it. We were doing something with a purpose, and we're not planning to do the entire course like that. It's just these certain areas that we feel need to be brought back to life.
Well, I was there that day, and I remember seeing you, Clyde, and Chris standing there. It's Clyde Johnson and Chris Haspel. And there was a lot of nervous tension in the air because taking on the challenge of rebuilding a major bunker and probably, as I've heard it be described, probably the most famous hole in golf that doesn't go on TV, and most copied hole in golf, and must have been pretty nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they shared my nerve. I think certainly Clyde was really excited about the prospect. And, you know, you saw yourself when we were up there, it didn't take them long to get going at all, pretty much within an hour or two, pretty much the rough shape of what was going to be there was in, and the tee that was on top of the bunker there as well, you know, had come out. We're moving that across to the left, again, to provide a bit of a bigger teeing ground, but also takes it away from the line of play. But yeah, I mean, it was quite a sight to behold, you know, two 14-ton excavators working in close proximity.
Why not try Eden Mills The Guard Bridge blended malt whiskey or golf gin? Visit our sponsor's site, www.edenmill.com, for more information. Eden Mills St. Andrews, bringing the art of distilling back to St. Andrews. And at speed,
yeah.
I tell you what, these guys work. There's no flags out, there's no nothing, they just go for it. Yeah. And they're so inch perfect. I honestly, the speed they go at, and I was shocked at how good they were.
Yeah.
They were rolling grass, turf off the ground with these massive excavators.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot of skill just to even know how to use one of those, let alone be able to do what they can do with it. And I say to my guys whenever we're kind of in the vicinity of Chris and Clyde's, like, just watch how impressive this is, because we could all try and emulate it, but never to that extent.
I was blown away about the skill these guys have, and their understanding of how to create a natural shape was with a huge bit of kit.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
That's the impressive thing for me, certainly about Clyde, Chris as well. But I like to think that I've got an eye for certain things and I can do certain things. It's not until you see someone like that and you realize, actually, I don't have that skill at all. I mean, the creative mindset that he has and that artistic, you know, mindset that he's got, he didn't work off a plan. He knew in his mind what he wanted to do. So seeing that in action's impressive. I mean, like I say, if that was myself in the digger trying to do that, it wouldn't be anywhere near.
And he did it in an afternoon.
Yeah.
It's like painting fine art with a fist. You know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's really shocking how impressive it was. We've got a wee video of it that I think we're going to have coming out soon. So we'll keep an eye out for that, guys. So that's quite a lot going on. Have you got any more projects that you're planning?
So over the course of winter, we're planning to rebuild 15 or 16 bunkers as well. So we've done two already, two at the left side of the 12th green. And then there'll be, you know, just other bunkers around the course, with a wee bit of gentle landscaping around the sides to try and get them back to kind of how they... Not the same extent as what the 15th bunker was, but just trying to make them, you know, fit in their surround a little bit better.
Now, this is a question that I probably shouldn't ask, but it must have been quite a bizarre scenario when you've just come into... Did you have any sort of insecurity around the fact that you've just come into your job and then you've got these two guys coming in who are obviously world-class at building bunkers and doing things... Must have been quite daunting for you having these guys come in and be like, oh shit, what am I doing here?
No, I mean, Chris and Clyde are...
They're charming, aren't they?
Yeah, probably two for what they've done in the game. I mean, you know, Clyde's got a fairly short career, and already what he's achieved is, you know, to be respected. But I mean, very humble guys.
Yeah.
Chris, someone I've looked up to for a long time. You know, you look at him as a bit of a mentor as well. I probably as much as a friend now as anything as well. And Chris is great in the sense that he's always at the end of the phone if you need him. If you're not sure about something, he'll happily answer. You know, he's never short to give you advice and how he would tackle something. You know, if he hasn't encountered a problem before, he'll know someone who has and is always willing to help you out. So they've been absolutely brilliant to work with.
Yeah, but it's like having a 3-star Michelin chef come into your kitchen when you've been in the job for 6 months, you know, and it must be a massive compliment that they want to work with you, knowing that that's the case. It's
yeah,
cool.
And I'd like to think that we offer them the same flexibility as, you know, we afford them. And I think that's where our probably relationship works quite well, where if we gave them a brief and they had to stick to it and, you know, give me exactly what I want, they would probably be stifled and they probably wouldn't be able to create what they want to. But, you know, North Berwick's bigger than me. So, you know, by looking at these old pictures and old photos of how the course used to look or how bunkers used to be, it is important for them to be able to have that creative license and artistic license to be able to do what they need to do. And, you know, I'm fairly hands-off in that sense where, you know, I'll just let them work away. You know, I'll go up and check in them periodically and we'll talk about what they're doing, whether there's a little bit that, you know, I'd like to see slightly changed or whether there's a bit that they're not sure about, we can talk it through. But it's a very open dialogue and a good relationship.
Well, that's great, because I know what you're doing is very exciting for everyone involved. Is there anything that when you're working with these guys that you go, oh, bugger, he's not thinking about this, but I need to, come on, guys, this is important, like health and safety or like...
It's probably everything that ties into what they're doing. You know, so Clyde's coming in with a view to, you know, shape. So he's moving soil and he's maybe not concerned about where it's going or, you know, what's maybe coming behind it. Whereas, you know, part of my stress is we've got to put irrigation in and we've got to get turf in and we've got to do this and we've got to do that and managing bodies and staff to do these things. So, you know, as I always say to the guys, patience and flexibility is the key when they're on site, because we know that in a moment's notice we might need to change our plans or what they initially wanted to do has changed. But that's all part of the fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's if you don't have that flexibility, then you won't get the job done. And it's especially when these guys are working so fast. There's at North Berwick, what are the, apart from maybe the coastal erosion we talked about, what are the difficulties as the course manager that you're faced with that you find maybe you have certain areas that grass might not grow properly, or what difficulties are you faced regularly?
I don't know if there's difficulties as such that are different from anywhere else on the course. It's maybe we're a very, very busy golf course.
Yeah,
pretty much from 7 o'clock in the morning until dusk in the height of summer, we've got golf out, which kind of inhibits how much work that our guys can actually do. So we have an early start to try and get ahead of them. You know, obviously there's an expectation for a good condition course all year round, which we can't always promise. You know, there'll be days that we need to top dress or, you know, punch holes somewhere that maybe the golfers don't want to see, but unfortunately it's just, you know, golf maintenance. But probably trying to fit everything in around a packed tee sheet. I mean, the makeup of the course is we've got 3 clubs essentially that play their fixtures over the course. And that's a lot in itself without, you know, a fully booked tee sheet from visitors as well. And, you know, we're delighted that we're providing, you know, a once in a lifetime experience to a lot of members or visitors. And it's great that they want to be able to come here and spend their time, but sometimes it's just you're desperate to get work done and you just can't move for golf. But it's a nice problem to have.
Maybe if the golf course was on a bigger footprint, it would be easier, but it's not on a big footprint.
It's a long footprint. I think it's not far from the clubhouse to the 9th hole, which is the kind of furthest out point. I think it's just short of 3 kilometres. So it's a long footprint, but it's not wide. So, I mean, we've pretty much got holes side by side right along the coastline. I think the strange bit is our coastal holes, you know, the ones right on the coastline, we don't really suffer with worm casts or, you know, anything like that, because they're on quite sandy soil, but literally just moving another hole over. So 3 and 16 as an example, 16, and then obviously further over again, the wee course, the children's course, there can be quite badly hit by worm casts and the soil's just slightly richer. So that's probably one of the bigger headaches that we have, is trying to manage that and, you know, trying to cut and present good quality turf when you've got maybe a lot of worm casting through the autumn months is difficult, but it's just part and part of the topography that we have.
But that's the thing, you're talking about 10 metres.
Yeah.
It's crazy. A lot of people don't realise the... can you give me a wee understanding of what you do at the kids' course? People don't really understand what you have there, this little nine-hole golf course.
Yeah, so we've got this nine-hole course that is predominantly for use of children in the town or nearby, and, you know, it's meant to be prohibited to adults. It should be, you know, if you're playing, you've got to have a child with you. And it's just, you know, this small, you know, par three course, essentially. And we manage it exactly the same way as we manage the main 18 holes here. The greens can get pretty quick in the heat of summer. But yeah, it's great. It's a great space for kids to come and play and learn how to learn the game. We have a get into golf program, which is run by Katie in the pro shop and the pro team, where they take people who maybe never really experienced golf before, get a chance to kind of learn and develop and get a chance to play in the course before maybe graduating onto the bigger course here or another course in the area. So it's a great kind of breeding ground and a training ground for a lot of people in the area. And, you know, I think Katrina Matthews probably the most famous, you know, person to come out of that.
Yeah, she won a few of the comps there.
Yeah.
I grew up playing my junior golf there, and it's quite an amazing place. They have five majors or four majors, and then the players. and they're all very historic cups. Yeah. One of the cool things I heard about North Berwick the other day is it has the oldest junior competition in the world.
Yeah.
Which is quite amazing. 1968 or something.
Yeah.
That's one of the cool things about this golf course. It's the same golf course that's been played here since, I don't know what, how, 18,
the club was formed in 1832. So, you know,
yeah,
coming up to 200 years old, but they kind of say that golf's been played a couple hundred years prior to that.
Yeah.
For anyone that knows the course, the original boundary was the kind of wall that's at the back of the 15th green. So it was six holes, a six-hole loop, I think, played three times. And then the course was extended out to Eel Burn, which is just in front of the 7th green. And then laterally, the course was extended out to holes 8, 9, 10, and 11.
One last thing that you didn't, that we didn't include in the, I would say, footfall you have on the golf course is the fact the number of walkers you have. Do you have problems with them walking up and down on rough areas or creating paths that you don't want them there?
Most of them are fairly respectful. I mean, you get the odd one or two that, you know, you kind of see them doing things you shouldn't be doing, like walking over greens with their dogs, and you kind of wince a little bit, or throwing balls down the middle of the fairway and dogs running about. But I think it's part of the charm with North Berwick and the fact that there's this close proximity to the town. It's almost an extension of the town.
Well, it's owned by the town.
Yeah. And it's one of these things, you know, I think we'd always struggle to police dog walkers and walkers on the course. But, you know, like with the old course at St Andrews, the great joy for people is that on a Sunday, people can play football, they can picnic, they can do whatever on the course there, and it's public land. And I think, you know, that's part of our charm as well, the fact that we've got that here. It's frustrating for golfers, don't get me wrong, especially on the second hole when the tide's in and you got a massive folk walking down the right of the fairway. But it's one of these things that we can't help.
So what do you see as a common golfing normality? So divots or whatever, pitch park repairing, that frustrates you as a head greenkeeper? Maybe like not picking up tees on tee boxes. What would be the ones that you'd want people to respect greenkeepers more?
Yeah, I mean, the big ones are always going to be pitch marks and divots. You know, with the amount of play that we get, we have a lot of divots on the fairways that, you know, take time to heal. And, you know, we do have a divot squad that go out there, but you know, they can't really keep up with the amount of divots that are out there. So yeah, definitely replacing divots and pitch marks are the two big ones. But I think there's just the element of course etiquette at times, and you know, certainly for greenkeepers, we know all too well about being in the firing line and people saying, "Oh, we didn't see you," or you know, you put a bit of rope and stake out to try and stop people walking somewhere, and you see people just walking over it. I think those are the kind of big frustrations that you get, but sometimes it's better. The things that you don't see and don't know about are probably best that way.
Out of interest, there's a lot of people, the divot stuff, I hear different not to replace it, to replace it. What's your, you think replacing it is better, or is it?
I would think it's one of those, certainly on the tee, I wouldn't worry about replacing divots on the tee. They're managed a bit more intensely than the fairways are, and a bit more concentrated as well. But certainly on fairways, I don't think you can't really go wrong with putting a big divot back if you take one out, you know, a big fillet stake divot. You know,
does the root system stay within the grass?
Yeah.
I was always trained. I'd get death stares by my dad if I didn't replace a divot. That's a classic. He was a farmer, so that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. and in terms of repairing a pitch mark, what's the best way of going around that? Would you?
Yeah, so pretty much pushing towards the middle. So I think a lot of folk think that you're trying to pull it up from the middle, but instead you should actually be putting your pitch mark repair in and pushing it towards the middle to fill in the hole that way, as opposed to lifting it up and kind of ripping the roots out from there.
Oh, is that what happens? It rips the roots out. Sorry, I just, those are two questions I think people will find interesting. and lastly, I've always liked to finish on one thing. Two things actually. Things tend to go on sometimes. Firstly is, what's your top five favorite golf courses? Ely's one for me. It doesn't mean that they're the best golf courses, but you're just the ones that mean something to you, your favorites.
Yeah. North Berwick aside, obviously, I would say...
It doesn't have to be five. Simon Holt gave us 13.
Okay. He's played a lot more golf than me. probably definitely Balmoral. That's definitely special. Ballater, if ever I'm home and I get a chance to play Ballater, I always take that up. Royal Melbourne as well is kind of a place I hold really high up. Muirfield as well, it's kind of going with a theme of places I've worked. But probably the outlier would be Royal Porthcawl.
Oh, yeah.
Down in Wales. I was lucky to be invited down to a greenkeeping event there last year. And I've known Ian Kinley, the course manager there, for a few years, and always kind of really enjoyed seeing what they were up to in the course, going through a bit of a redevelopment, and getting down there, it was just breathtaking, and loved the golf course. The clubhouse was just, I think it's an old cricket pavilion.
Yep.
And it's just wall to wall, floor to ceiling, old memorabilia, just a great place to be in and a great place to socialize. But I was just blown away by the golf course.
I've heard the whole setup there is just special. Yeah. Just the experience, all round experience. Did you, I don't know if you would have been able to, because of the fact that there's probably was there a few greenkeepers there for
that?
Yeah,
there was, I think there was about 50 of us all together.
Do you meet up quite a lot, greenkeepers?
Yeah. That's probably a really good thing about the industry, is it's a small industry. So a lot of people know a lot of people. And we do have a few events a year. So BTME, which is the kind of British Greenkeepers Turf Show down in Harrogate, is a great chance in January to kind of go down and see, you know, latest developments, machinery, fertilizer, whatever else. But it's probably a better chance to catch up with your peers and people that maybe haven't seen for a few years. I've been very lucky that I've been invited to an event called the Lynx Club for 3 years now. And that's pretty much Lynx greenkeeper or Lynx course managers from around the UK going to different parts of the UK to see different golf courses, and just a networking thing really. And you know, the first year I went was Carnoustie on the championship course, which was brilliant. Second year was Royal Porthcawl, and this past year we were down at Fairhaven and St Anne's Old Links in Lytham.
Okay. Yeah.
Which unfortunately the weather was pretty bad, so we got rained off at Fairhaven, but the company that you get and the people you get to meet is brilliant. And even, you know, last week as well, I was invited to an event up at Carnoustie for a seed launch. And it was kind of course managers from along the east coast. And again, you know, guys you maybe know, but you don't necessarily know that well. It's just a great chance to kind of speak to them in a quite a relaxed setting.
What do you think's next for greenkeepers? What's the next big solution, whether it be, I don't know, automated grass cutting, or what do you think is going to happen next?
I think the big one that's coming is going to be water management. A lot of courses run off mains water, which, you know, isn't ideal, but maybe don't have access to water elsewhere. And it is, you know, our greatest public resource and something that we should be proud of and try to keep. But we need to be sensible with how we put water out and how we use it. You know, like I said, on the Lynx courses, where if it browns off from, you know, getting a little bit dry, it's not the worst thing in the world. But maybe on other courses, they see a brown patch and think, oh, we need to get the water on. It's maybe just managing things like that. That's going to be the big challenge. That, along with, you know, reduction of the chemicals that we can use. We don't use a lot of chemicals on North Berwick, but there is a few that we use, you know, fungicides after, you know, a seeding event, or an insecticide to kind of manage the chafer grub population, things like that. You know, if we lose them, that could be quite a disaster for the industry and a lot of courses, when the expectations of what we need to produce are quite high. Staffing is going to be another one. I think every industry in the UK at the minute is feeling a crisis with staffing and trying to get people into roles, and greenkeeping is no different. You know, we've actually picked up a lot of guys that haven't come from a greenkeeping background and wanted to try something new, which is great for us. They've kind of taken the job really well, but there maybe isn't the same interest there was 10, 15 years ago of a place like North Berwick putting a job advert out and maybe getting inundated. Now it's a little bit harder to find that staff.
Well, that's the thing. For a lot of people, seeing the very early hours outside in the dark, cutting grass is probably not something that a young guy just out of university getting up at 12 o'clock wants to see, you know, or out of college or wherever.
Yeah, but I mean, if that's what you know, and the perk of the job, I mean, you'll know
you have
as well as me. I get to the first green in the morning and you've got the sun rising over Bass Rock.
Oh, it's one of the most beautiful spots.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of people that come down here and they've maybe never visited East Lothian before, they never came to North Berwick, and they get to our sheds to drop something off and they're like, wow, this place is just incredible. And I think sometimes I take it for granted, and, you know, you kind of forget how special a place it is, and you just kind of look at it as work and you look at the things that you need to improve. But certainly the days when you stand back and you look out at the sea and see the different, you know, the scenery and whatever else, it is a really special place.
Even those big orange sunsets and sunrises, they happen all the time.
Beautiful.
Especially because you get so little cloud coverage here.
Yeah.
A lot of sun. Is there anything you'd like to say to young people in the game that might want to emulate or move to the same heights that you are?
I mean, probably just for anyone that thinks about getting into the industry, it's a great industry to be part of. Probably one of the very few industries that you could literally work anywhere in the world. I think, you know, without getting in my soapbox here, I think we maybe don't do a great job of promoting the job to people as well as what we could. I think, you know, like I say, I was 16 when I wanted to be, or maybe 13 or 14 when I wanted to be a greenkeeper. You speak to career advisors and they say, oh, well, you don't need any qualifications, and they don't really give you much more information. But once you're kind of in the industry, it's quite a wide umbrella of different roles that you could have. You know, I've pretty much stayed within golf course maintenance and greenkeeping, but, you know, there's sales, there's, you know, research and development, there's agronomical work, there's design work, there's construction work, there's, you know, machinery work. There's all these different facets of the industry that probably not a lot of people know about and maybe accidentally fall into. But maybe if people knew about it from an earlier age, something that, you know, like I say, us as an industry have to maybe get better at and promote the industry better. It's a great industry to be part of. And, you know, certainly the people I've met along the way, I've got friends for life that you might not speak to for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. But as soon as you meet up, it's, remember when we used to work together, or do you remember when we did this event together? And, you know, you just pick up from where you left off.
That's one of the cool things, especially if you're doing a good job like you are. the members at a golf club like this tend to, it's almost like their second wife, you know, it's their second husband. It's the love for the golf course they're a member of, you know?
Yeah.
It's so.
And that's evident in North Bennet. There's a real pride in what they have here, and rightly so, because it's a spectacular place and, you know, the course kind of speaks for itself. So, you know, it's part of our job to make sure that they're as happy as they can be when they're coming here to play. And whether it's a member that's been here 50 years or whether it's a visitor coming from the other side of America for the first time, you know, we want them to have a special experience.
Well, you're very much doing that. So thank you very much, Cal. That was superb. I really enjoyed that.
No, thanks for having me on.
Kyle, thank you very much for sitting down with me. I know you're incredibly busy with all the stuff going on, and I want to thank you for doing a very, very good job on the golf course that I love. So thank you. If you want to get in touch, it's james@top100golfcourses.com, or get me on Instagram, @officialtop100. I'm always happy to hear even just a gripe. I had someone with something recently and I really enjoyed having an email exchange with them. And please remember, play fast, lunch slow.